National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
France became the first country in the world to enshrine access to abortion in their constitution this week. How might this impact other European nations? The Register's Europe correspondent, Solène Tadier, joins us with insights on this troubling development. But first, we remember the angelic doctor, St. Thomas Aquinas, 750 years after his death. We are joined by one of the great saint's spiritual brothers, a fellow Dominican, Father Aquinas Gilbo. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and your host here on Register Radio. This is a great moment to look at St. Thomas, a 13th century saint. He is known as the angelic doctor and the common doctor, and we remember him especially on March 7th, the day of his death. So St. Thomas lived from 1225 to 1274, and he was from Italy. He's known as a philosopher and a theologian, and he was a Dominican. We are going to learn a lot more about his life from a fellow Dominican. That is Father Aquinas Gilbo, a Dominican of the province of St. Joseph. He is currently University Chaplain and Vice President of Ministry and Mission at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and he did his doctoral dissertation on St. Thomas Aquinas' doctrine of common good. He's also taught moral theology at the Dominican House of Studies. Father Gilbo, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you. Happy feast day.
Yeah. Yes, happy feast day. I was going to ask you the very first thing was how is your community celebrating this?
So Dominican communities around the world are celebrating in different days. You know, March 7th does mark the actual 750th anniversary of St. Thomas's death. So it's quite a year, quite an anniversary. And so here in Washington, between the two communities, the Dominican House of Studies, we also have a parish in downtown D.C., St. Dominic's. Between the two communities, we have 2 days worth of celebrations, and we're looking forward to those.
So you mentioned this is the year of his death, so the 750th anniversary of St. Thomas's death, but we really are in sort of a jubilee of St. Thomas, aren't we?
That's right. Providence has so arranged sweetly and wisely for us that St. Thomas Aquinas, was born 800 years ago, roughly this year. He died 750 years ago this year, and was canonized 700 years ago this year. And so we can remember all three of those anniversaries roughly at the same time, all those events 50 years apart. So we are celebrating something of a major jubilee of Aquinas.
Absolutely.
This year.
Absolutely. So anyone who's taken classes in college, theology classes, or maybe even philosophy classes, has mm-hmm. has probably studied something of St. Thomas's work, the Summa Theologica and whatnot. But what would you say to a more general audience is the most enduring legacy of St. Thomas?
Well, I think his most enduring legacy is his entire corpus of work, and just not just the conclusions he reached and the texts that he produced, but also the example of a Catholic scholar, a Catholic philosopher, a Catholic theologian, a Catholic priest and religious who pursues wisdom and knowledge for the sake of enlightening his brothers, enlightening the church, enlightening everyone in terms of what God has done in creation, what he's done even more wondrously in our redemption, in the incarnation, and the marvelous mysteries he has prepared for us at the end of time. All of these things fascinated St. Thomas as a human being, and especially as a Christian and a priest, and he spent his short 50 years on this earth applying his incredible intellect to mystery by mystery, article of faith, article by, by Article of Faith, plumbing their depths and drawing much of what, you know, we can know and understand of God's own purposes and God's own work, you know, in these mysteries. So we do recognize him as the common doctor, the angelic doctor, but common for everybody. He's common. He's the common teacher of everyone in the church. And I think this is played out in his legacy. You know, it was his doctrine of charity, for example, that was unique in the High Middle Ages when he taught, and that became an enduring legacy. I mean, the way the church talks about charity now in terms of friendship with God, you know, Aquinas was one of the first to speak in those terms. His doctrine of the sacraments, I mean, how it is that God works efficaciously through the sacraments and liturgies of the church to share his life with us, you know, in grace. You know, Aquinas' way of describing that mystery was taken up by Trent and kind of made part of the common teaching of the church for, you know, for all of us. Every time we attend Mass on Corpus Christi, every late spring or early summer, those are the texts of St. Thomas that the church
prays. I was hoping you would get to that.
Yeah. He was not only a brilliant priest and philosopher and theologian, he was something of a mystic and a poet, too, who spent much time in prayer, was just fascinated by the Eucharist, and was invited by the Pope at the time to compose the texts for the new Corpus Christi liturgy. And so, there are just many things that one might admire about Aquinas, and just many ways in which his legacy is still enjoyed by the church today.
Yes, I do want to I want to delve a little bit deeper into that that Eucharistic connection. I didn't realize this, but as I was doing some research in honor of St. Thomas and for his for this commemoration, I realized he was also titled, you mentioned angelic doctor and common doctor, but Eucharistic doctor by Pius the 11th, and it, for good reason. I mean, St. Thomas Aquinas gave us, as you mentioned, some of the most beautiful hymns related to the Eucharist: Panis Angelicum, Pani Lingua, O Solitaris, Tantum Ergo. All these songs we sing often around adoration, or as you said, Corpus Christi. And the most beautiful thing is they did come out of his own devotion. Can you speak a little bit? There's so many like stories of his of his devotion. Can you give us some just to get a picture of this person who explained transubstantiation but also just had a deep love?
Right. Yeah, for Aquinas, the Eucharist wasn't a kind of intellectual puzzle to be solved, you know, for which, you know, he develops transubstantiation as a way of satisfying kind of the mind's you know, desire for a little riddle there. No, I mean, this was a mystery for him. This is a way in which God, through the incarnation of Christ, humbles himself, puts himself in our hands as a sacrifice to be offered, as a representation of his Christ sacrifice on Calvary, but also God becomes our food. You know, he feeds us with himself, and just as a Christian and a priest, Aquinas, you know, encountered this mystery every day. He was awed by this mystery. One of the legends of his life that come down to us is that he every morning, you know, would attend Mass twice. The first time was his own Mass as a priest. He would offer Mass as is good and just for every priest to do. But then just afterwards, after that first Mass at which his secretary would serve, then his secretary would offer his Mass, and St. Thomas would serve, you know, that Mass as an act of thanksgiving for the Mass that he had offered just before. So every day before Aquinas sat at his desk, before he returned to his books, time was spent with the Lord, not once but twice, at the Holy Sacrifice at the Mass, and certainly that shaped not only Aquinas' day, but the way in which he approached, you know, all of his work from just being fed by word and sacrament, and then Aquinas applying his mind for the rest of the day to plumbing the depths of that mystery just celebrated.
Yes, and since we are talking about his death at age 49, he seemed towards the end of his life to have so many mystical experiences, in such that I don't remember the exact words, you probably would, but he realized in a moment of kind of ecstasy that his own writings, his effort to describe the mysteries of God were absolutely nothing compared to what he could experience in these moments of deep spiritual ecstasy. And further, I read that he died after receiving communion, as difficult as he was, as sick as he was, he received the Holy Eucharist, and then went into a kind of ecstasy from which he never awoke. It's beautiful his
right.
Just how much he gave us, mm-hmm. and yet this just deep love that he had. I think we can all imitate in small ways.
Yeah, and it was always in service to Christ and service to His Church. You know, as a Dominican friar, but in service to Christ and the Church. Again, it was the Church's collective understanding of the Creed and the Articles of Faith that he spent each and every day expounding. He saw himself first and foremost as a commenter on sacred Scripture. I mean, that's what a theologian was in the Middle Ages. Certainly saw that as his primary duty, was to read the sacred word, mm-hmm. ponder the sacred word, and expound it through commenting on the Creed and the Church's practice and a life of Christian charity, just helping to make all of that clear, just the clearer we could be in our approach to that, the more that we can know and love God and in faith, hope, and charity. Just mysteries to ponder, things to give thanks to God for, and maybe mysteries to be revealed in glory.
Absolutely. Well, we are truly grateful for his legacy, and our listeners can read more at ncregister.com. You can find the article, Learning from St. Thomas Aquinas, 750 Years After His Death, and another article, A Dominican Remembers the Angelic Doctor, by Father Gregory Pine. And Father Aquinas Gilbo, I am so grateful for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, happy feast.
When we come back, the Register's Europe correspondent Solène Tadier reports on the impact of French lawmakers' vote to enshrine abortion into France's constitution. This is Register Radio on EWTN. Stay tuned for more.
Sacrifice is a profound virtue Catholics can lovingly embrace, especially during Lent. But this year, why not also indulge in something good for your soul? Give yourself the gift of EWTN's National Catholic Register and stay connected to the latest developments and historical traditions of our Catholic faith. Save half off your subscription today. Get the National Catholic Register delivered to your home, office, or parish, filled with spiritual insights on world events, along with compelling Catholic news and information. To get 50% off your subscription, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. It's the one indulgence you won't ever want to give up. Call or click today to save half off. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Executive Director of the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, and I'm your host here on Register Radio. Today, I'm joined by the Register's Europe correspondent, Solène Tadier. Solène grew up in Paris, France. She concurrently, though, writes from Budapest, Hungary, and she's been following with great concern the news about her homeland when French lawmakers enshrined the so-called right to abortion in their constitution. It's really a sad moment for France. Solène, I know you're looking at this with the same kind of sadness that I feel for the country once known in the Middle Ages as the eldest daughter of the church because of how Catholicism thrived, and now here we are. So, Solène, thanks for joining us, and I'd love first if you can report exactly what's happened.
So yeah, it has been a project that was actually a kind of reaction to your Dobbs, that what happened in the US in 1422. So that is actually interesting because it's, you have this kind of mirror effect. Like, it happened in the US, and of course, you know, France is well known for being very progressive and, you know, to be also always at the forefront of both de-Christianization, but also at the forefront of all these society, what they call progress. And so this kind of constitutionalization of abortion was a direct consequence of Dobbs, but it's been part also of the French mentality, you know, that has been growing over the past years. So, of course, when President Macron, as a communication stunt after Dobbs, proposed that, it was welcomed by a large part of French politicians and also of the population. So it was a very easy way to make the left happy, all these left-wing voters, and, you know, without being, you know, completely opposed by a big part of the population.
So. Right. And Solène, I mean, as you mentioned, it was just hardly any time had passed after the Dobbs decision was announced that basically overturned Roe versus Wade. And it was like, what, hours after that Macron actually said, well, we're going to make sure that this is enshrined, that our years of so-called progress aren't erased. And of course, this is where we are now. As I said, it's the first country to actually enshrine it into the Constitution, and that is quite startling. I think France has, from the numbers I have read, and maybe these are the latest numbers, I'm not sure, but 234,000 abortions registered in France in 2022. And so that the number of abortions has grown. It's the highest in 30 years at that point in 2022. And so it is a situation, it sounds to me, where the French people have just become so accustomed to abortion that they're really didn't sound like there was much resistance, Solène. Now, it wasn't a vote for the people. It was a vote by lawmakers, right? So what is the resistance like in France? Is there a pro-life movement? What kind of resistance or fighting for the unborn was happening on the ground?
So you're right in saying that, you know, abortion is really part of the French population, and what was very puzzling was to see a terrible, we could say that, the images of people partying in Place du Trocadéro, Esplanade du Trocadéro in Paris, you know, these scenes of jubilation with Beyoncé's hit Run the World Girls and et cetera, et cetera. You have this mentality, it's true, but those who are very pro-life in France are very active. At the same time, you had a big gathering in different parts, but mostly in Versailles, where the Congress was united to for the final votes. You had a lot of people who participated in this protest. And what is interesting is that many of them are very young people. So you also see this kind of new generation rising up, you know, to change the mentality. And what was also interesting was the fact that many French bishops were often accused of not being bold enough. This time, many of them made very, very strong statements in opposition to this vote. So something is happening, and some people think that, you know, this kind of radicalization of the pro-abortion movements over the past few years has also the effect of waking up consciences in France. So we could see interesting movements rising up, and one of their role models right now is the US again. You have more and more pro-lifers in France saying our strategy is not the right strategy. We should look at the US, what they do. They are so efficient, proficient. They are building centers to offer alternatives to women. We don't do that in France. We need to rethink our strategy. And the U.S. is the best model for us.
Well, that's a great point, and I know you have done your best to cover the ways that small communities are trying to revitalize their Christian roots, and not only in issues like this that touch the public square, but you know you have written stories that show the de-Christianization of France and of other parts of Europe really correlate to some of this unraveling on moral issues in the public square. A country that no longer recognizes their connection to the church and starts to, in some ways, change their concept of what a right is, right? I mean, they lose the sense of human dignity or even of the human person. And so I love that you have reported on that connection between de-Christianization and some of these so-called progressive laws. Where else, Solène, do you see the danger of this kind of enshrinement in law for things like abortion? Where else throughout Europe could be impacted by this vote in France?
Well, pretty much anywhere. It's very difficult to predict, but what is obvious is that somehow France could pave the way for many others to follow. You have already a lot of international journalists and politicians praising President Macron for his move and already calling for their local politicians to take up on this initiative and do the same locally. France still has this kind of influential power, this cultural influence over other countries in the West and mostly its European neighbors, of course. So it could definitely pave the way to that. So that's where you already have pro-life organizations and strong conservative movements in neighboring countries already rising up saying we must prevent it from happening in our countries. But that could definitely happen. You see how things can change. You know, in Poland, that was, you know, that banned abortion almost entirely in 2020. Now you have the Tusk government already designing a new bill to have it completely legalized. And, you know, already people are saying, yeah, we should also directly follow the path of France. We should do the same right now. It, you know, we'll go quicker. So things could be reversed very easily, but in one way or also in another way. So it also gives hope for the future if the pro-lifers are able to win the battle, the mentality battle.
Right. I think Spain is another place where in recent years legislation has allowed girls as young as 16 or 17 to have abortions without parental consent, and things like removing a period of reflection, a waiting period, you know, that helps allow an opportunity for people to slow down in their decision to terminate. And so these kinds of legislations come in all sorts of ways to make it more liberal, the abortion laws more liberal. But I agree with you regarding that, how concerning the celebratory aspect was across Europe and really the world or the Western world in regard to France's decision. Solène, what can still be done? I know that just last, well, I guess it was a couple months ago, in January, pro-lifers did gather in Paris, maybe 15,000 strong, and they were seeking they were promoting some proposals that could actually help women not to feel that abortion was their only resort. What kind of things are the pro-life movements working on now?
So many of them are now starting to rethink their strategies to be more proficient and to be more, let's say, efficient on the ground, I would say. And especially at the European level, you have like French pro-lifers who are actually lobbying European institutions, who are also very active in France, and they are trying to gather the testimonies of many women who had an abortion and who were faced with the consequences of that, to talk directly to lawmakers, to raise awareness, and then change the law to say, okay, then don't, you know, we have this state of affairs, but at the same time, we could also have an influence on the law saying that maybe we should lobby people enough, these lawmakers enough, so that we enable politicians, we enable the law to give women more access to what abortion really is, to really raise awareness. And that's, you know, you have all these kind of proposals to create more center to welcome women who are threatened, because most of the time the reason why they abort is because they were threatened by the father of the baby, because they were ill-informed, and because they felt that they didn't have the financial support to raise the kid. And we lack in France, we lack structures to answer that. And that's the awareness that is growing right now, is the lack of institutions and centers like that. And I think that we are going to witness the creation of more and more institutions like that. And that's probably the only really efficient thing that could be done in the coming years.
Well, Celine, I'm so grateful that you have been covering this. We look forward to more coverage of the pro-life movement in Europe as they really learn to kind of fortify their position and get into the culture and help to turn things around. And for our listeners, we invite you to go to ncregister.com, where there's a lot more news, analysis, and commentary. We're very grateful that you've joined us here on Register Radio on EWTN. And on behalf of my producer, Michael McCall, and myself, Jeanette DeMello, I pray that until next week, God bless you.